Thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode until the question-answer period of today's conference call. During the question-answer period, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one on the touch of your phone. You'll be asked to record your name prior to asking your question. At this time, I'd like to turn our conference call over to Mr. Dave Daigle. Sir, you may begin.
Hi, this is Dave Daigle. I'm with CDC Media Relations, and thank you all for joining us today on this short-notice telebriefing to discuss two New England Journal of Medicine publications, the emergence of a novel swine origin influenza A, H1N1 virus in humans, and human infections with triple reassortant swine influenza A, H1 viruses in the U.S. from 2005 to 2009. Joining us today are Drs. Michael Shaw, Lynn Finelli, Carolyn Bridges, and Fatima Dawood. And so I think we're going to dispense with the opening statements and just go right into the questions. Can we have the first question, please?
Thank you again. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on the touchscreen of your phone. Our first question comes today from Donald McNeil with New York Times. You may ask your question.
Hi. In reading over the article about the triple reassortant swine influenza A, I'm assuming this is tracing infections that do not include the Eurasian swine sequences that have been found in the patients in the current outbreak. And I wondered if you can tell us more about whether or not that Eurasian swine strain had ever been found in the United States, whether you can tell from genetic sequencing where it got into the combination along with these triple reassortants, or give us any more details of that.
Those genes had never been seen in the Americas before.
Wait one second. Don, this is Dr. Michael Shaw.
Thank you.
This was the first time they'd been seen in any virus in any human or animal. And the genetic lineage of the virus that we can trace back, there's clearly a gap in the surveillance because there are no really close relatives, nothing that we can say with an immediate precursor. Because of this new finding, a lot of researchers in the field are going back through their archives now, digging through their freezers to see maybe if they had something that was overlooked. But there is absolutely nothing in the literature, nothing publicly available, and nothing that our colleagues knew about when this was first found.
This is Carolyn Bridges. I think it's also important maybe to just point out, and we would want to send questions over to USDA as well, but from our understanding, there are no importations of pigs into the United States from Eurasia.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Maggie Fox with Reuters. Match question.
Oh, darn. I wanted someone else to ask them first. Can we go back over that? What is it that's new? And any hint as to whether somebody might have carried this reassortant to Mexico or whether it emerged there, considering that the surveillance we have is of people who had that triple reassortant in the U.S.?
This is Michael Shaw again. The genetics are indicating that there was the origin of this virus apparently happened before anyone was aware of it occurring in animals or humans. It was six of the genes were similar to what had already been seen in the Americas circulating in pigs and that we knew about. The acquisition of these two new genes from the Eurasian lineage had never been seen in the Americas. There is importation of pigs, the way I understand, to Europe and Asia for breeding purposes, but not the other way around. So whether it might have come into this hemisphere by a person or an animal, we have no idea. We're not in a position to say right now.
Thank you, Maggie. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Mike Stope with Associated Press. You match question.
Hi, thanks, doctors, for doing this. Two questions. The first one, I saw in one of the articles, we saw this in I think the MMWR too. 38% of cases in the U.S. looking at the U.S. cases also involve vomiting or diarrhea. That's not typical of seasonal influenza. What explains that in this virus? Can you give us any information about what is it about this virus that's causing those symptoms at a higher amount?
Yes, this is Fatima Dawood. We did find in the first 642 cases or of patients who were diagnosed with swine origin influenza virus infection that 25% either had diarrhea or vomiting. This is a new virus, and we're still learning how transmission occurs. But because we've made this observation, we are recommending that clinicians think about transmission not only through a respiratory route, but also through the gastrointestinal route and fecal-oral transmission. But it's not fully understood what role those symptoms play yet.
Thank you, Mike. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Heidi Flute with Internal Medicine News. Match question.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. This is sort of a follow-up to the previous question. What right now is the take-home message then for clinicians relating to this as far as symptoms to watch for or what to tell patients?
This is Fatima Dawood again. In our paper, again, we looked at the first 642 cases and we found that the majority of people with confirmed swine origin influenza virus infection had symptoms that are typical of seasonal influenza, and those would include fever, cough, and sore throat, which were the three most common symptoms observed. As mentioned previously, diarrhea and vomiting were prominent symptoms as well. So what I would say is that clinicians and people should be aware of those symptoms, and I think that if members of the community have symptoms that are concerning to them, they should discuss that with their clinician.
Thanks very much. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Danielle Danoon with WebMD. Match question.
Thanks for taking my question. I have to just push a little beyond this. Perhaps you all noticed that there was also a paper published at the same time about the signature features of pandemic flus in the past. And it strikes me that that these flus continually seem to have some of the features that we're seeing here, striking younger people, and that there is a wave phenomenon. I wonder if you could comment on the risk groups that you're seeing for this virus and what we might expect looking forward from our experience of pandemic flu about what future waves of viruses tend to look like as they become pandemic. I know that's a wide question, but I'd appreciate your addressing it. Thank you.
Why don't you comment on the age distribution?
This is Fatima Dawood, and I would say that this is an evolving outbreak, and we're still learning about how this virus works. But what we observed in our paper is that 60% of confirmed cases occurred in people who are 18 years of age and younger. Now, there may be several possible explanations for that. One is the possibility that younger people are more susceptible to the virus, but there may also be a bias in the way that we are finding cases right now because the number of cases were identified in school outbreaks, and so more young people are being tested right now. There is also the possibility that older people may have some antibodies to other influenza viruses that give them cross-protection against the current virus. I think it's difficult to make predictions at this point.
This is Dr. Carolyn Bridges. In terms of the second part of your question about what we might expect, of course, we'll have to sort of wait and see. That's always the tricky part with influenza. We never sort of know what we're going to get until we get there. But with past pandemics where there's been a novel strain, where there has been initiation or introduction of that virus, the initial outbreaks, if they occur in the summer, are generally milder. We know that the influenza virus in general prefers lower humidity, lower temperatures for transmission. So as we're in the summertime, we expect, as we do with seasonal influenza, that what we're likely to see is some transmission that occurs over the summer, with the possibility that in the fall, when the weather turns cooler again, that we might see an increase in cases. We'll be looking closely toward the southern hemisphere during their winter that is coming up to see what happens, and that may give us some clues as to what we might expect in the upcoming winter months here in the United States.
Thank you very much. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Warren with Bloomberg News. You may ask a question.
Hi. Thanks for taking the question. I was wondering if you could talk more about whether the ancestors of this virus may have been circulating in people before it was in pigs, and whether that might have given immunity to older people. Thanks.
This is Michael Shaw. Well, ultimately, all of the ancestors of this particular swine strain and the circulating seasonal H1N1 strain can be traced back to the 1918 pandemic. That virus established itself both in humans and in pigs, and they've been evolving along separate tracks. And in the process, they being both mammalian species, they've maintained the ability to go back and forth, which is what we've seen, obviously, for example, in the other paper we're talking about today, they are able to make the jump. What's unusual about this particular case is that it's able to apparently establish sustained transmission. What's clear from what we're seeing genetically and just the behavior of the virus, it was already well adapted for transmission in humans before it popped up in this particular case. But ancestors are the same. You can trace them all back to 1918.
Thank you, John. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Elizabeth Weiss with USA Today. You match question.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a follow-up on that, then. You talked about there may be a missing link in observation or surveillance. How much observation and surveillance is there worldwide, and how likely is it that you would actually see in something close to real time a virus like this popping up?
This is Carolyn Bridges. I think what we can say is that we certainly are much better prepared this year than we would have been a few years ago. And although what we were preparing for most urgently was potential emergence and spread of H5N1, the avian virus, those investments have paid off in spades. And so we have invested from the U.S. government with many colleagues from different countries and other donors in increasing laboratory capacity in countries around the world. So I can't tell you for sure how early we might be able to have identified this virus, but we certainly are in much better shape than we would have been even just 2 years ago.
Thanks, Beth. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Mary Manning with Las Vegas Sun. You match question?
Yes, thank you for taking my question. I'd like to know if there's been any studies done on how long this virus lasts when it gets out in the environment.
This is Michael Shaw. There have been no... We haven't had the virus long enough to do studies on this particular one. All we can go by is past experience with other influenza viruses, and it depends on the environmental conditions. It survives better on a hard surface than a porous surface, for example. It's inactivated quickly at higher temperatures. Those are just general facts about flu, but these particular strains, people are working on it. We just don't have that information yet.
Thanks very much. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brian Thompson with KS Public Radio. Mass question.
Hi. Thanks for this opportunity. As for the predecessors of this virus that emerged in pigs in the late 1990s, the Humane Society of the U.S. has made the argument that intensive factory farming is responsible for the shift in the genes that caused all this to happen. I'd like you, Jürgen Rick at Kansas State University, by the way, argues that backyard pigs would be more susceptible because they are exposed to more viruses that are left by bird droppings and such. So I'd like you to weigh in on that, please.
This is Carolyn Bridges. I'm not sure that we can really speculate about that, given that what we believe based on the data that we have available from the genetics databases is that we don't have any precursors like this in the United States, despite a tremendous amount of surveillance that goes on here in the U.S.
So I can't speculate. I wouldn't be able to say one way or the other.
Thanks very much. Next question.
Thank you. Again, I'd like to remind parties who would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on the touch on your phone. You best record your name prior to asking a question. Our next question comes from Carrie Payton Balberg with Sacramento Bee Newspaper. You may ask a question.
Hi, thanks for taking this question. As we continue to do genetic analyses of this virus throughout the southern hemisphere flu season, what markers, if we start seeing changes in different markers, which ones would be especially troubling? What areas of this genome do we not want to see change, or would be early signs that it's changing in ways that could make it much more problematic?
This is Michael Shaw. There are several critical parts of the genome we look at. Obviously, the one of primary concern right now are the determinants of resistance to the antiviral agents. That's going to be a high priority to continue monitoring. Also, any potential changes in the surface proteins that could potentially complicate selection of a vaccine strain. As you know, under ordinary circumstances, circulating influenza varies a great deal, which is why the vaccine has to be updated every year. There is the possibility that once it starts circulating more widely in different populations, that you're going to see little subpopulations popping up that could not be reactive with whatever vaccine strain might be chosen. So we just have to keep an eye on changes in general. But the ones we look for in particular are the ones that are affecting the genetic makeup of the proteins that react with the vaccine and antiviral resistance or susceptibility.
Thanks very much. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Mike Stobe with Associated Press. You may ask a question.
Hi, thanks. Here's the second question I was trying to ask earlier. There's a little more detail on the chronic conditions that some of the severe cases in the U.S. had. I was wondering, especially in the cases of the two deaths, that 22-month-old child had, looks like, four conditions, and the pregnant woman had had several, including autoimmune disease that was under treatment. Can you tell me about those constellations of underlying conditions? Would seasonal flu have killed those patients, given those conditions, or are you learning anything about the patients who suffered severely, who had underlying conditions? What's working together there?
This is Fatima Dawood. I think we're still learning about what patients are most at risk for swine origin influenza virus and complications of that infection. But what we do know from seasonal influenza is that there are certain groups of people who have characteristics that confer a higher risk. And those groups include children younger than age 5, people with chronic underlying medical conditions, pregnant women, and adults older than 65 years of age. And one thing that we looked at in the 642 patients that were described in this paper, and then in the subset of patients who were hospitalized, we had data for 22 patients. About half of those patients had one of those characteristics. Which does suggest that those groups of people may be at higher risk. Those groups may not be the only groups, but certainly we are seeing that those groups are well represented amongst the people who are hospitalized at this point.
Thank you, Mike. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Elizabeth Weiss with USA Today. Match question.
Hi, thanks again. Just a quick question. I'm reading these papers, some of it, facts are actually from May 5th. I'm wondering, when are these going to be published, and have you all ever done this quick a turnaround before? I don't recall having seen it.
Hi, this is Lynn Talley. I may be here the longest of anyone at this table, and I've never seen such a paper come out so quickly, I don't think. Is that what the question was?
Right. I mean, there's data in there that's from 2 days ago. So, I'm wondering, when is it going to come out in print? And then, from your memories, I mean, some of the AIDS papers came out quickly, but quickly meant 3 or 4 weeks. I've never seen anything show up 2 days later.
I think the print version of both of these papers is going to come out the first week of July.
This is Carolyn Bridges, but I understand that these versions are available online to anyone, so not just by subscription, but and anyone would have access to these papers.
And this is Fatima Dawood. I would just add to that this paper is an effort by so many people in county and state health departments as well as CDC to really make this information available as soon as possible to people.
Yeah, and this is Michael Shaw. We want to emphasize that we were getting this genetic information out basically as soon as we had it. We had the first gene segments up there in April 25 and made special arrangements with NCBI at NIH to have them released essentially as they were submitted. So April 27th, things started getting up on the NIH NCBI website right away as soon as we had the data. There was no holding back of it.
Operator, this is Dave, and I think that was our last call, so I want to thank everybody for taking the time to join us today and ask questions, and we'll plan another daily update briefing tomorrow, a regular CDC press briefing. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. At this time, that does conclude today's conference. All parties may disconnect.